British-born author Nick Bunker has written books on the Mayflower Pilgrims, the Revolutionary War, and a biography of Benjamin Franklin. Lately, he turned to America and the world in 1950. His book is titled In the Shadow of Fear. Nick Bunker, a graduate of King's College, Cambridge, and Columbia University, focuses on names like Joseph McCarthy, Harry Truman, Dean Acheson, Margaret Chase Smith, George Marshall, Robert Taft, Alger Hiss, Winston Churchill, Joseph Stalin, and Mao Zedong. In addition, Bunker pays close attention to the Korean War.
My name is Nate, and I'm part of the team at C-SPAN that brings you live coverage of Congress and the day's top political events unfiltered. As a nonprofit organization that receives no government funding, we're asking for your help to support C-SPAN's daily operations. Please visit cspan.org/donate to learn more and consider making a one-time or recurring tax-deductible donation. That's cspan.org/donate.
Nick Bunker, I'm looking at a piece of paper in front of me from June 1st, 1950. At the heading, it says Margaret Chase Smith, Declaration of Conscience. Let me read just a paragraph, and then you can put this into context of your book. She said on the floor of the Senate on that day, "It is a national feeling of fear and frustration that could result in national suicide and the end of everything we Americans hold dear. It is a condition that comes from the lack of effective leadership either in the legislative branch or the executive branch of our government." That was in 1950. What was that all about?
Well, Senator Margaret Chase Smith is a favorite character of mine. And she was giving this speech on the Senate floor, really in response to the activities of Senator Joseph McCarthy. Now, she was a Republican, Senator Smith, Republican from Maine, the only woman senator in the Senate at the time. She knew McCarthy pretty well because she had sat alongside him on various Senate committees. And she had become increasingly worried and alarmed by the activities of McCarthy in 1950 as he began his anti-communist crusade with his charge that the State Department was riddled with communist sympathizers. She was worried by the fact that he was making what she thought were unsubstantiated allegations. She was worried by the tone of his activities. And that was really why she made this famous speech, which came to be known as the Four Horsemen speech.
Go ahead.
She was also concerned about the Truman administration, too. She was very critical of Harry Truman as well as McCarthy, which is something which is often forgotten.
So what got you interested? I know you've written about the Revolutionary War, Benjamin Franklin, lots of other things, American. What got you interested in the 1950 mark?
Well, as you say, my previous books were about colonial history, partly about early New England, also about Benjamin Franklin, and about the onset of the revolutionary crisis in the 1770s. But when I finished my Franklin book in 2017, 2018, I really felt that I needed to become a little bit more up to date because of what was going on in the world. 2018 was a year when we really saw a steep deterioration in relations between the United States and China. It was also the year, of course, in which we in the UK were coping with the consequences of our referendum on Brexit, our decision to leave the European Union. There was a sense of deepening chaos and disorder in the world. A lot of talk about great power competition. A lot of talk in some quarters about possibly a second Cold War. And that was really what led me to want to write about a period, a crucial period in the first Cold War, when there were similar signs of discord and discontent on both sides of the Atlantic.
One of the things that got my attention were your epigraphs in front of each of the chapters. I'm just going to read one, and you can take off from there. "I think we shall continue to win the Cold War," Senator Tom Connally, September 1949. What was that about?
Well, I always like to start my chapters with an epigraph because I want to set the tone of things, if you like, by quoting from an eloquent speaker from the period. Now, Connally was speaking there in the fall of 1949, at a time when the Senate and the House of Representatives were considering some important legislation. This was the legislation that would permit Harry Truman to send huge amounts of military aid to Europe. military aid for the formation of NATO. He wanted to send more than $1 billion worth of military supplies to Britain, to France, and to the other countries in Western Europe to beef up NATO. And of course, the context of this was the concerns about the Soviet Union, and particularly the concerns in the fall of 1949, because the Soviets had just detonated their first atomic bomb. They had tested that in Soviet Central Asia in August 25th, 1949. So there was a deepening sense of concern about the Soviet Union, and a deepening concern about the fact that although NATO had been created, there was a North Atlantic alliance that existed on paper, as yet it didn't really have the wherewithal in terms of armaments and so on to stand up to the Soviets if there were a crisis.
Do you have a thread that you like through this whole book that you did on purpose?
Well, yes. What I was trying to, the book is, if you like, a kind of a parable in some ways, a kind of historical parable about the dangers of disunity and the dangers of discord in the face of an external threat. As I said, when I began to work on the book in 2018 or so, there was concern about great power competition. There was concern in some quarters about a possible second Cold War. And I wanted to say to people, look, if we're concerned about there being a second Cold War, then let's look at what happened during the first Cold War, and let's look at the domestic circumstances in the United States, in France, in Great Britain, and elsewhere, and to see how those were how those existed at the time. And let's examine, for example, the question of whether or not the United States was actually in shape at that period to face the kind of challenges it had to confront overseas.
What did you find out about Harry Truman that made an impact on you?
Well, I have mixed feelings about President Truman. The way I would put it is this. I think you've got to distinguish between Truman, the man, and the president, and on the other hand, the Truman administration. Now, I think President Truman had many admirable qualities. He was a genuinely modest and humble man. I mean, he had a personal lifestyle that was very simple and modest, and I think that's quite admirable. It's certainly not something one associates necessarily with British presidents today. He was also a man with a very clear set of principles and ideas, which he had developed really from his early manhood. He was a great admirer of Woodrow Wilson before and during World War I, both of Wilson's domestic policies, his new freedom concept, and also his intervention in World War I. So he had a set of clear principles and ideals, and Truman really was a man who believed in fairness, which is why his principal domestic agenda at the time of this book concerns was what he called the fair deal. Now, I think the difficulty with Truman was really the Truman administration itself, which had a very mixed record. He was very good indeed at picking secretaries of state. He had two excellent secretaries of state, George C. Marshall and Dean Acheson. He also had a very good defense secretary during the Korean War in the shape of Robert Lovett. But the rest of his administration really didn't live up to those kinds of standards. The word that was often used about them was that it was mediocre. They were accused of being a mediocre administration. And the problem really was that they weren't very effective in terms of getting their domestic policies done. I think that's the difficulty I find with this particular period. A president with some admirable qualities, but an administration that in many ways was dysfunctional, not least because the Democratic Party at the time was also a dysfunctional party.
What was the fair deal?
Well, the fair deal was Harry Truman's attempt to carry forward, consolidate, and develop further the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt. Now, when he came into office in 1945, Harry Truman began to speak about the Fair Deal. And he then developed it further after he was elected to the presidency again in November 1948. It was the centerpiece of his State of the Union message in January 1949. And the Fair Deal would have been a program, quite an ambitious program of legislation and reform. It would have included, for example, a new farming policy. It would have included measures to strengthen the labor unions. It would have included universal health care, a system of universal health insurance. It would also have included civil rights legislation. And it would have included a package of measures, for example, for federal aid for education and for projects for land reclamation and irrigation and so on in the West. So it was an ambitious package. The difficulty was that it ran out of steam, lost momentum, and Truman was never really enabled to enact anything more than kind of a fraction of it.
When you mention civil rights, I have to ask you, because you talk about this man in the book some, but if you walk over to the United States Senate office building, as you know, One of them's named after Richard Russell.
That's right.
Of Georgia, a Democrat, and he was in the same party with Harry Truman. What role did Richard Russell play during those times?
Well, Russell was one of the most influential Democrats in Congress. He was probably among the top four or five Democrats in Congress at the time. And of course, he was the leader of the Southern Democrats. And the Southern Democrats were immensely powerful. I mean, half of the Democrats in the House of Representatives, for example, at this period, came from the old Confederacy or the border states of 1861. Now, Russell's role here was really twofold. When it came to foreign policy, he was a firm supporter of Harry Truman's initiatives. He was a great believer, for example, in air power, strategic air power. So, of course, he was delighted by the decision to build the hydrogen bomb. But on matters of domestic policy, he was much less reliable from Truman's point of view. And in particular, of course, he was a staunch opponent of any civil rights legislation. And during the period that I deal with in 1949 and 1950, he worked with Republicans to, in effect, thwart the various attempts that were made, partly by black congressmen in Congress, but also by Truman himself, to enact some civil rights legislation. So unfortunately, the kind of vision for civil rights that Harry Truman had developed, particularly in 1946, 1947, really didn't come to pass. And Russell played a major role in ensuring that it didn't.
How did you go about researching the book? Where'd you go?
Well, I was able to do most of the research before COVID. Because when the COVID lockdowns began on both sides of the Atlantic in 2020, of course, that put an end to my archival research. Fortunately, I'd already done the bulk of it while I was in the United States before that period. I was actually in the United States as the COVID lockdown started. I was on the last British Airways normal scheduled flight out of New York before the COVID lockdown started. I got back to England and then our lockdown started about a week later. So I had my research, fortunately, in the bag, so to speak. And it was done in various locations. Some it was done in New York at Columbia University, where they have excellent oral history collections. I was able to use, of course, the National Archives in Washington, D.C., various state collections and so on. So a great deal was done. Unfortunately, the effect of the lockdowns was I wasn't able to visit the Truman Library itself in Independence, Missouri. But they have excellent digitized collections, and of course that was really saved that particular point. So I had done most of the research before COVID began, and then of course during the lockdowns, I was able to concentrate on writing and putting things into shape. And as I say, digitization has been a great boon in the preparation of this particular book.
My questions may sound a little scattered because there's so much in this book. I want to ask you about the Venona Papers, because when you get into the Alger Hiss and the Klaus Fuchs and all that, and we can talk about who they were, the Venona Papers must have had some role with you. And where are they? What were they? And how did you use them?
Well, the Venona Papers, of course, at this point were totally secret. They were a very closely guarded secret, known only to people working in the upper echelons of the intelligence establishment in Washington. The Venona Papers were, in fact, a set of decrypts. They were decrypts of wire traffic between Moscow and Soviet embassies abroad. These were decrypts that had been... effectively, what had happened was that the American intelligence services, particularly U.S. Army intelligence, had broken the Soviet diplomatic code. And so they had collected these intercepts of radio traffic, and then over a long period of time and after a great deal of hard work, a very complex endeavor, they had managed to decode what the Soviets were saying to each other. Now, at this particular point, as I say, this was totally secret. Within the higher echelons of intelligence establishment, though, it was known. And some of the most sensitive of the Venona decrypts included references to a man who may well have been Alger Hiss, who, of course, was... at this particular point, a hugely controversial figure. He was put on trial for perjury twice in 1949 and early 1950, convicted of perjury, identified by some as a Soviet agent in the 1930s. So the Venona decrypts pointed possibility that Alger Hiss was a Soviet agent. Now, at this time, as I say, this was a closely guarded secret. But it was a secret that, as I say, was known to the upper echelons of intelligence and informed their thinking about the possibilities of communist subversion inside the United States.
Talk about, for a moment, Klaus Fuchs. I know we can talk about Alger Hiss easily because it comes up a lot in this country. But Klaus Fuchs, German by birth, spent some time in your country, spent some time in this country, and then Stalin knows about the bomb that we're going to drop before Harry Truman?
Stalin certainly knew that the United States was working on an atomic device. He certainly knew that. Now, the role of Klaus Fuchs was simply this. Now, Klaus Fuchs was a physicist. He was a German physicist. He had been a member of the German Communist Party. And because he was a member of the German Communist Party, of course, he had left Nazi Germany in the 1930s, and he had made his way to England, where he had become a very senior scientist with the British. He was, in fact, the head of theoretical physics at the British Atomic Research Establishment just outside London. He had also spent time on secondment in the United States during World War II with the Manhattan Project, working at Los Alamos, where, of course, the atomic bomb was being developed by J. Robert Oppenheimer and his team. So Fuchs was privy to a great deal of secret work on the atomic bomb, and he was also aware of the early work on the hydrogen bomb, too. Now, of course, Fuchs was actually a Soviet agent, and this became known because of some of the Venona decrypts. The Venona decrypts appeared to point to the existence of an agent within the atomic research establishments, both in the US and in the UK. And the FBI and British intelligence as well, and the British police, were able to identify that agent as being Klaus Fuchs. He was arrested in England early in 1950, subject to quite complicated interrogations, and he was eventually persuaded to make a confession. And the news of Klaus Fuchs's arrest and of his appearance in court in England in February 1950 caused an enormous stir. It caused an enormous stir in America. In Britain, actually, didn't cause quite as much of a fuss, because in Britain there was a lot less interest in and a lot less public knowledge about the atomic bomb program. But in America, it caused a huge fuss, because it was taken by many to be a sign of the sheer depth of Soviet infiltration. So it's caused great worry. And of course, it was all the more worrying because the revelation that Fuchs had been arrested and brought up in court in England in 1950 on charges of espionage came only a matter of days after the conviction of Alger Hiss for perjury in New York.
So you said that Dean Acheson was a good Secretary of State for Harry Truman, but what happened in his relationship with Alger Hiss? Alger Hiss was at Yalta. And how does that fit in? And do we have a confidence today, based on Venona, that Alger Hiss was actually a communist spy?
Well, to answer your second question first, I think the Venona decrypts, the evidence of Venona decrypts, are not entirely conclusive about the identification of Alger Hiss as a Soviet agent. It's not 100% certain. However, what is clear is that during the 1930s, Alger Hiss had certainly been involved with had certainly had communist sympathies. That seems to be clear from the details of the two trials. That seems to be clear. And it's also clear that at this particular point in January and February 1950, even though people weren't aware of the full details of the Venona decrypts, it was a fairly natural assumption to link the Fuchs and the Hiss cases together. So it did cause an enormous row. And then that led, only a matter of days afterwards, of course, to the further controversy aroused by Senator Joseph McCarthy's criticism, his claims that there was serious communist infiltration inside the State Department.
But why did Acheson stick up for Alger Hiss amidst all that, when everybody else was suggesting that he had been a communist or was a communist?
And well, how much
of a story was it back then that Dean Acheson had stuck by him during the hearings and everything?
Oh, it was a very big story. Now, there were really two elements to this. The first element was there was a personal connection between the two men. Donald Hiss, who was Alger Hiss's brother, was a partner in the law firm Covington & Burling, where Dean Acheson had also been a partner. But in addition to that, Alger Hiss was a familiar, well-known figure in Washington circles. He had been employed at the State Department for a long time. Acheson knew him well, and he had every reason, from his point of view, to see Alger Hiss as a high-quality individual who had done very good work in Washington. Acheson, from his point of view, had no reason to doubt what he thought was Alger Hiss's integrity.
Here's another epigraph. This leads into Chapter 4. To be a successful politician, you have to be on intimate terms with sin. William J. O'Dwyer, mayor of New York. Why did you use that?
Well, Mayor O'Dwyer of New York was a fascinating character. I think he was a man who actually achieved a great deal in his career. He was an Irish-American Democrat from Brooklyn. He was actually an Irish immigrant. He was then a policeman in Brooklyn. And he became mayor of New York after World War II. And he was up for re-election in 1949. Now, O'Dwyer did a great deal for New York. He was a great builder of public housing. He was the ally of Robert Moses, the famous Robert Moses, the builder of the Cross Bronx Expressway and the man who kind of shaped the infrastructure of New York. And O'Dwyer and Moses worked closely together. O'Dwyer was in many ways, as I say, a very astute, very shrewd politician, did a great deal for New York City. But unfortunately, he was an Irish-American Democrat from Queens, from Brooklyn, at a time when New York City Democratic politics was still heavily influenced by political machines. And those political machines had some shady connections. O'Dwyer fell foul of this. O'Dwyer fell foul of the fact that he was linked to a man called Frank Costello, who was the most powerful organized crime figure in America at the time. People were able to link the two men together. They had some dealings with each other. In addition to that, O'Dwyer fell foul of the fact that there was corruption inside the New York Police Department. At the time, New York was beset by a huge problem of illegal gambling, numbers, rackets, and so on and so forth. And in 1949 and 1950, it was revealed that these illegal crime syndicates or illegal gambling syndicates had been paying off the police, particularly in Brooklyn. O'Dwyer had always been very close to the police department, even former policeman himself, strongly supported by the policeman, by the New York Police Department. And when this scandal broke, as break it did in 1950, O'Dwyer became a casualty. O'Dwyer was, in fact, had to resign as mayor of New York. He was appointed by Harry Truman to be U.S. ambassador in Mexico, but his career ended. The reason it's important, really, is because what O'Dwyer emblemizes, or what he kind of symbolizes, if you like, is the problems the Democratic Party had at the time with its connections with these political machines. It was partly because of O'Dwyer that the word corruption came to be associated with the Truman administration. I'm sure you'll be aware that 1952, during the November 52 election, which of course led to the presidency of Dwight D. Eisenhower, people said there were really three issues, Korea, communism, and corruption. And the corruption issue partly came about because of the kind of revelations that were made about Mayor O'Dwyer and his administration in New York.
Harry Truman, president since April of 45, all the way up through to 1952. When you started writing about this, how popular was he right as you lead up to 1950?
Well, he'd won a tremendous victory in November 1948, a victory which many thought was against the odds. Many pundits and pollsters had predicted that Truman would lose the election in November 1948, that he would lose to his opponent, the Republican Thomas Dew of New York. But nevertheless, Truman won. But the problem Truman had was that his popularity had always been related to one particular factor, and that was the economy. If you look at Truman's popularity ratings throughout his administrations, they tended to go up and down according to, for example, the rate of inflation or economic prospects. When inflation was high, his popularity rankings went down, and when inflation was low, his popularity rankings went up. Now, during 1949, he suffered from the fact that there was a recession. First half of 1949, there was quite an economic recession that was quite alarming at the time. It actually turned out to be quite mild, but nevertheless, it was quite alarming. And that led to a big plummet in the popularity ratings of Harry Truman by the fall of 1949. And then a whole series of events occurred which kind of caught him off guard and led to his popularity to fall even more during 1950. So that it was quite a low ebb when the Korean War began in June of that year.
What started the Korean War?
Well, it was Joseph Stalin who started the Korean War. It was Joseph Stalin who gave the go-ahead for Kim Il-sung, the dictator of North Korea, to invade the South in June 1950. I mean, that's now very clear. There was a lot of controversy over this for many years, but the controversy was kind of settled in the 1990s when the Soviet archives began to be revealed. Began to be revealed because they haven't still not entirely open. And of course, now in the last year or so, they've kind of become closed again. It became clear when the archives were opened that it was Stalin himself who, at the end of January 1950, personally gave the authorization for Kim Il-sung to begin preparations for the invasion that occurred on June 25th, 1950.
As you study that whole period and you go back to Yalta, you go back to Potsdam after the war was over, did we and Britain win or lose at the table with Joseph Stalin?
Well, that's a very complicated question. And it's one which, of course, Winston Churchill pondered a great deal in the years that followed. I think the answer to that is that the mistakes had probably been made earlier than that. I think what ought to have been clear really by the fall of 1944 was that the possibility of a post-war accommodation with Joseph Stalin really wasn't there. It should have been clear from the fall of 1944, after the way in which Stalin behaved towards Poland, that he was going to be a very difficult character to deal with. Now, I think the deals that were done at Yalta at Potsdam were probably as good as could be done, given the kind of balance of forces, given where the various armies had settled, had ended up in Europe at the end of World War II. Nevertheless, from the moment really that the Yalta and Potsdam agreements were concluded, from that moment forward, critics in the United States and elsewhere, critics in Europe too, already began to argue that there had been a kind of betrayal of Eastern Europe. Now, I don't think the word betrayal is appropriate, but the fact of the matter is that these deals were not as good as they should have been.
So, put this into context for us. In February of 1945, at Yalta, you have FDR, Churchill, and Stalin. Then FDR dies in April. And then in July, you have the Potsdam Conference. And there you have Churchill for a while. And then you have Clement Attlee from Great Britain. Then you have Stalin, but then you have Truman. How did Truman do compared to, and how do you think FDR himself did? He was so sick when he was at Yalta.
Well, as I say, I think these deals were really as effective as could have been done, given what the situation was, given where the armies had ended up at the end of World War II, given the huge military strength that the Soviets could wield, and given what they had already achieved. I think the difficulty really was earlier on, when the Western Allies, failed really to recognize the kind of person, the kind of regime they would be dealing with after World War II. They tended to think that they could maintain a degree of cooperation, a degree of harmony with Joseph Stalin and the Soviet, which I don't think was really realistic.
So going back to the cabinet of Harry Truman, who was not effective? You name those that were effective, like Lovett and Acheson and some others, but who was not effective?
Well, one character was not effective was the Treasury Secretary, a character called John Snyder. John Snyder, kind of a forgotten figure. He was a Treasury Secretary at the time that I'm writing about in my book, In the Shadow of Fear, in 1949-1950. The difficulty with him was that he was really not particularly on top of the economics of his brief. He was not a particularly effective negotiator. And he was symptomatic of this tendency in the Truman administration for there to be a lot of unevenness. There were some like Acheson and George Marshall who were very on top of their briefs. There were others who were really much less effective. But it wasn't really just John Snyder. In general, there was a tendency in the Truman administration not to be able to carry through and execute what the president was actually seeking to achieve. The Justice Department was another example. Now, with a view, for example, to the question of civil rights. Now, Harry Truman was unable to get through Congress any significant civil rights legislation. It simply wasn't possible because of the sheer power of the Southern Democrats at the time. It ought to have been feasible, though, to use the Justice Department more aggressively to implement the kind of civil rights, implement existing legislation. It ought to have been possible to use the Justice Department to be more effective, and they didn't do so. There was a tendency in the Truman administration to say for a kind of a sort of a fuzziness and a vagueness about what you might call managerial government. There was also difficulties, I think, in terms of the way they prepared legislation. The legislation often wasn't as carefully drawn up, as carefully planned and programmed as it might have been. They ran into big problems, for example, with their universal health care legislation, where they were unable to devise a kind of a program that could command widespread popular support. And so that kind of ran out of steam as well. Also in the face of a huge amount of lobbying by interest groups who were opposed to exactly what they were proposing, particularly from the medical profession.
As you know, during that period in the early 50s and all, the Republicans got control of the House and Senate for a couple of years, which they hadn't had for years and years. And then it went on all the way up until the 80s. Until the House of Representatives turned Republican. What impact did the House, why did it go Republican for a couple years in that period when Harry Truman was president? And what impact did that have on his fair deal?
Well, that was November 1946. That was when the Republicans gained control of Congress. And the reason for that really was just down to that single word, inflation. Now, people had always known that after World War II ended, there would probably be a burst of inflation. Because during World War II, the American economy had been quite tightly controlled. There were various, all kinds of administrative mechanisms in place to keep prices down, to keep wages down. Also, there was a high taxation as well. So the amount of demand in the economy was artificially kept under control. Now, when those controls were dismantled after the war ended in 1946, it was kind of inevitable that there would be a burst of inflation because there would be all kinds of people with money in their pockets wanting to spend them on new apartments or on new washing machines or cars or refrigerators, whatever else it might be, at a time when supply was still short because the economy was still converting back from wartime production to domestic production. So there was a huge burst of inflation. The trouble was that the Truman administration was really quite, they didn't handle that dismantling of controls as well as they might have done. So the burst of inflation was really quite severe in 1946, at a time also of a lot of labor unrest. There were great waves of strikes in 1946 and 1947. What happened was that Harry Truman ended up taking the blame for this, and that's really why Congress went Republican in November 1946. And they held on to Congress for 2 years. And during that time, the Republicans were quite effective. There were two big things the Republicans did which left a big mark. The first was they passed a thing called the Taft-Hartley Act, which covered labor unions. And that, to some degree, rolled back some of the legislation, pro-labor legislation, that Franklin Roosevelt brought in 1935. And the other thing the Republicans did, which was very effective, was they cut taxes. They slashed income taxes in 1948 by about $5 billion. Now, $5 billion today is not a lot of money, but it was a great deal of money in 1948. They slashed income tax by $5 billion, and as a result, they opened up a big hole in the federal budget. And that big hole in the federal budget became a really big problem for Harry Truman in his second term in 1949 and 1950, because it meant that he had a problem with his defense budget. He couldn't afford to spend as much money as he should have been doing on the Pentagon. And he couldn't afford to promote some of the other great programs that he wanted to do under the Fair Deal. So that Republican period in 1946 to 1947, with control of Congress, actually had quite a big effect, both on the labor front and also in terms of undermining the kind of liberal programs that Harry Truman wanted to implement.
Here's another epigraph, and I'm reading it primarily because if you think about where we are today in this country, this was back in 1949-53. It's from Joseph Martin, who was a minority leader. He did become speaker once for a couple of years. Our political system was out of joint. Instead of two healthy parties, we had one party bloated with a too long tenure and another party reduced to dark frustration. In this unwholesome state, some Republicans turned to extremism. I kept reading in this book, and I kept thinking about today. And how about you? Did you have the same reaction? There was a lot of things that happened then that it sounds like the same thing that's going on now.
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, that's really what I meant earlier when I was talking about the book being kind of a historical parable about the dangers of disunity and discord and polarization. Joseph Martin, the Republican there, was describing, primarily, he was talking about McCarthyism. He was talking about Senator Joseph McCarthy. Not just McCarthy, there are other Republicans too who are allies of McCarthy. But that's what Martin was talking about. And as indeed, yes, it struck me as something which does have parallels with our situation today in 2023.
Why did you go to Columbia University? What drew you there?
I graduated from Cambridge University here in the UK in the early 1980s. And what happened was this. I'd always been fascinated by American history anyway. But in 1980, I worked for the summer in Venice, in Italy. I worked in a museum in Venice, in Italy. And I met a number of Americans. There was an American Air Force base, big American Air Force base near Venice called Aviano. I'm sure some of the listeners will know about this. It's a very big American Air Force base, one of the biggest in NATO. And a number of the U.S. Air Force personnel from there were working in the same museum that I was. They had just left the Air Force, and I was working with them. I got to know them very well, and they said to me, "No, you really must come and live in the United States. You really must come over and spend some time there." And so what I did was I applied for a fellowship to study at Columbia University, and I was successful. And so I came to Columbia in 1981. And also there was another aspect to it, which was that I wanted to study under a particular academic at Columbia, a chap who's now very famous, quite controversial, the late Professor Edward Said. He was teaching there, and I wanted to join his seminars, and that's what I did. And so I spent 2 years living in New York. During the course of that time, however, it was a difficult economic period in the UK. I realized that I wasn't going to be able to pursue an academic career, and so I decided to look around for something else to do. So I enrolled in the Columbia University Journalism School with a view to getting a job on a newspaper when I got back to England, which I did in Liverpool when I arrived back in 1983.
Why was Edward Said, who's deceased, controversial when you were in his class?
Well, he was controversial because, of course, he was Palestinian. And he was, at that time, the leading Palestinian intellectual probably in the world. And he was particularly concerned, obviously, with that particular issue. 1982, when I was there, was a quite a difficult year, because that was the year, if you recall, during which the we had the Israeli Defense Forces were engaged in Lebanon. It was the year of the notorious massacres at Sabra and Shatila in Lebanon. Edward Said was very heavily involved in all kinds of discussions about these matters. He was writing a great deal. He was speaking a great deal. He was a controversial figure as a Palestinian operating in New York. Now, actually, the reason I had come to study, and it wasn't because of that, I'd come to study under him primarily because I was so impressed by his, I was at that time a student of literature and literary history, and that actually was my primary reason for going to study under Said. But I found myself there at a time when this other issue, the Israel and Palestinian issue, the Israel and Palestine question, was enormously live. It was enormously controversial, and he was right in the middle of that controversy.
How many years did you spend with the Financial Times, and what did you cover?
I was at the Financial Times for about 6 years. And I began as a general news reporter there. I was also for a while a parliamentary correspondent. And then I moved on to the financial side of the paper. I covered the banking and insurance industries. And then I ended up working on a thing called the Lex column. The Lex column is the kind of investment commentary column of the Financial Times. It's a bit like Heard on the Street in the Wall Street Journal. And I worked on that column as well for a couple of years before I moved into the City of London myself, into the financial markets.
In this book you've just written, there's a lot of talk about journalists. I'm going to take a quote from another epigraph and ask you how this fits. This is chapter 8. In the age of atomic energy transmuted into a weapon which can destroy great cities, a serene president of the United States sits in the White House with undiminished confidence in the triumph of humanity's better nature. That was from Arthur Kroc of the New York Times, February 1950. Why'd you use that?
Well, you know, this really was a golden age of journalism. There were some superb columnists at this period, very eloquent columnists, famous figures of the time, Walter Lippmann on the New York Herald Tribune, also Joseph and Stuart Alsop, also on the New York Herald Tribune. There was a great journalist in the New York Times called James Reston, Scotty Reston, who was a hugely important figure and a really superb journalist. And there was Arthur Kroc. Arthur Kroc was the Washington bureau chief of the New York Times. And he was quite a very august figure, had a beautiful house in Georgetown, a very important social figure. And he was a member of a club, a private club, to which Harry Truman was invited for a dinner in February 1950. Just after the conviction of Alger Hiss and just after the news of the arrest and putting on trial in London of Klaus Fuchs, the spy. And what happened was this. Arthur Kroc suggested to Harry Truman that it might be a good idea if maybe he, Arthur Kroc, interviewed the president, for the president to put his side of the story and to put his case for what he was doing to if you like, relaunch the Truman administration. Now, that was quite a controversial thing to do at the time, because actually in those days, presidents weren't supposed to give one-on-one interviews to exclusive interviews to a particular journalist. But Harry Truman did that. And the words you quote come from the Arthur Kroc's piece that arose from that interview. And it caused a great big row at the time because the rest of the press corps in Washington were very upset that the president should have given a one-on-one exclusive interview to Arthur Kroc. They were very upset indeed. So it caused a great big row, and it turned out to be counterproductive, as these things often are, because the controversy about it kind of rather drowned out Harry Truman's message.
You mentioned Walter Lippmann. Let's take another epigraph quote from him, March of 1950. The Truman administration has not had for over a year a single new, interesting, and constructive idea to which the nation can rally.
Well, that's again a very interesting quotation because, you see, generally speaking, Harry Truman has a pretty good press these days from historians, from academic historians or popular historians. He's a historian he's a president whose reputation has really risen over the years. And it's worth remembering that at that particular point, and this is, by the way, before the Korean War began, at that particular point, that wasn't the prevalent view of Harry Truman. There were many commentators, such as Walter Lippmann, who took a very negative view of Harry Truman and of the Truman administration. They used that word mediocre to apply to it. Now, what Lippmann was really talking about there was the fact that Harry Truman had to some extent lost control of Congress. He simply couldn't get legislation passed. And the legislation he did try to pass was, in Lippmann's view, unrealistic. Lippmann was really talking about there, for example, about the failure to pass universal health insurance legislation, the failure to get a civil rights bill through, and the fact that Harry Truman kind of had got stuck fiscally. Because of the great big hole in the budget that the Republicans had opened up with their tax cuts in 1948, Harry Truman really couldn't do very much about anything. And that really was what Lippmann had in mind. Lippmann was also really saying that there was a sense in which the Democratic Party as a whole had kind of run out of ideas. Remember, by now, the Democratic Party had been in power. They'd had the White House for nearly 20 years. And they were starting to look like a kind of a tired party. They were starting to look like a stale party. And that's the kind of thing that Lippmann had in mind.
Talking about journalists, you suggest that reporters from the Washington Times-Herald helped write the Wheeling, West Virginia speech for Joseph McCarthy. What was that speech, and how much did they write of it?
Well, McCarthy was very close to certain journalists. He was particularly close to journalists who were associated with the McCormack family. Colonel Robert McCormack, who was proprietor of the Chicago Tribune, the Washington Times Herald that you mentioned, and the New York Daily News. And McCormack very strongly believed that there was a communist conspiracy inside the United States. He also very much believed that the Democratic hegemony of the country needed to be ended. And he was determined to see a Republican president in 1952. He was determined to see Truman's party ousted from power. And he did lend, indeed, a great deal of support to Joseph McCarthy. And it is indeed the case that the Wheeling speech, the famous Wheeling speech of February 1950, in which Joseph McCarthy launched his anti-communist campaign, was to a large extent concocted and devised and sourced from journalists for the McCormack papers, whether the Chicago Tribune or the Washington Times Herald.
What'd you think of the speech? I assume you read it.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's of course, the funny thing about that speech is we're not quite sure what McCarthy actually said, because the versions of it that survive are the if you like, the typewritten transcripts of his speaking notes. But McCarthy was notorious for the fact that he used to deviate from his speaking notes. We don't really know exactly what he said, but we do know enough to know that it was a very explosive incendiary speech that caused a huge impact. The central allegation in it was the allegation that there were 57 card-carrying communists inside the State Department headquarters in Foggy Bottom in Washington. That was the central charge. The numbers were a little bit vague. Somebody said 57, somebody said more than 200. But that was the gist of it, that the communists, that there were Communist Party members or sympathizers actually in the upper echelons of the State Department.
How much attention was paid to that speech right after he gave it?
Well, initially, for the first few days, not very much. There were wire service reports from the Associated Press, which circulated of the speech. And initially, these reports were only carried really by state, local, city newspapers in the United States, not really by the big papers in the East Coast. But over the next few days, what happened was that Joe McCarthy just kept on repeating the same message. He gave more or less exactly the same speech a few days later in Reno, Nevada. And he talked incessantly to the press. And he was pursued over the coming days by kind of posse of reporters from one city to another as he went on a speaking tour of Nevada and California. And so gradually the speech became more and more controversial. Gradually it got more and more coverage. And within a week or so, McCarthy had become kind of a national sensation. Now, up until that point, McCarthy had been quite an obscure figure. He was a very young senator, the youngest man in the Senate. He'd only been in the Senate since January 1947. This was really what made his name. And one of the reasons for that, unfortunately, was the way the Truman administration reacted to it. The Truman administration reacted to it in quite an explosive fashion. And because they reacted in quite an explosive and angry fashion, I think they probably made more of the story than it should have been. And then what McCarthy did was, a few weeks later, he went onto the floor of the Senate, and again he repeated the same allegations at much greater length and for hours on end, standing for hours on end on the Senate floor. And that really pushed the issue right into the foreground of public attention. Coming, as I say, just after the arrest of Klaus Fuchs, and also coming just after the conviction of Alger Hiss. Put all those things together, and you had your sensation.
Going back to where we started, the Declaration of Conscience speech by Margaret Chase Smith. Here's just another paragraph. That was on June 1st, 1950. But by the way, before I read this, when she gave that speech, how controversial was Joseph McCarthy at that point?
He was certainly becoming controversial. He had turned himself into something of a national celebrity. Now, it's quite striking that at that particular point, if you had an opinion poll, and there were many opinion polls at the time. Gallup polls have been around since the 1930s. If you had an opinion poll and you asked Americans to list the most important issues of the day, mostly they would talk about bread and butter economic things, the high cost of living, for example, or they'd talk about strikes, or they'd talk about worries about the economy. They didn't necessarily list the Cold War as being their top priority. Now, what McCarthy did was to push the Cold War and to push issues about communism way up the agenda. And so in the course of a few months, he transformed the kind of public debate in the United States. He achieved record levels of name recognition that other senators could only envy. And by really May, June of that year, at the time she gave that speech, he had become a national sensation. And that was quite a remarkable thing for him to achieve. And he did it really because he talked to the press incessantly. He took risks in terms of what he said. He made allegations that he couldn't substantiate, but he just went on making them. And also, other leading Republicans began to fall in alongside him, particularly the most distinguished Republican of the time, which was Senator Robert A. Taft. Robert A. Taft was the de facto leader of the Republicans in Congress. And a really important moment came in March, April 1950, when he decided to throw in his lot with Joseph McCarthy. Once that had happened, then McCarthy could not fail to become even more of a celebrity. And that was really what Margaret Chase Smith was responding to. She was responding to that because she found it alarming. She belonged to a more liberal element within the Republican Party. She wasn't a follower of Senator Taft. She belonged to a more liberal element, and she was very concerned. At the same time, though, she was also very concerned about the Truman administration. She felt the Truman administration was directionless. She didn't like some of their policies. She felt they weren't spending enough on defense. She was worried about confusion in high places with various members of the Truman administration fighting each other. She was worried about the defense secretary, a chap called Lewis Johnson, who she thought was a particularly weak leader and a particularly difficult character. And so put that all together, and you had her Four Horsemen speech. It was both an attack on McCarthy, but it was also an attack on the Truman administration, too.
And you pointed out earlier that she was the only woman in the Senate. Today there are 25. From her speech, this quote, "Those of us who shout the loudest about Americanism in making character assassinations are all too frequently those who, by our own words and acts, ignore some of the basic principles of Americanism." As a Brit, how do you read the word Americanism? What does that mean?
Well, that's a good question. How do I read the word Americanism? I think what she had in mind was a basic commitment to, obviously, basic commitment to what she saw as the principles of the Constitution, a commitment to certain to principles of fair play, the rule of law. She meant, I think, a commitment to freedom of speech. She meant all the kind of things which we regard as being, which she would regard as being a sort of central elements of the American way of doing politics. And what she worried, of course, what she was worried about was that President McCarthy, Joseph McCarthy, Senator McCarthy, if you like, was trying to change the rules of the game. He was going to change the rules of the game in a way that she thought was fundamentally destructive.
So there was another thing that you write about, and one part of it was the speech that Acheson made at the press club, but it's NSC 68. Why was that so important back then? What did it mean?
NSC 68 was a document drawn up by the National Security Council, which is called NSC 68. Technically a top secret document, although in fact word of what was in it seemed to kind of leaked out in Washington quite extensively. NSC 68 was a policy statement for America's stance in the Cold War. It was drawn up by a man called Paul Nitze, who was the head of policy and planning at the State Department, working for Dean Acheson. So it was very much the product really of the two men together. And it was intended to be a kind of a rallying call. NSC 68 was based on the premise that the Soviet Union was devoting an enormous chunk of its economic output to preparations for war, that the United States was falling behind, not just the United States, but also the other Western allies, Britain, France, Italy, etc., and that there needed to be a kind of a rallying call should go out, so that America and its allies should try and equal the Soviet Union in terms of their spending on military output, and prepare themselves for a long struggle. That was really the core of it, the notion that the struggle with the Soviet Union, the Cold War, would be a long confrontation, and that the United States would need to mobilize all its own resources and the resources of its allies to bring that struggle to a successful conclusion. So that's what NSC 68 was. Now, it didn't specify particularly figures about how much America should spend on the military, but probably it would have involved, if it had been fully implemented as intended, it would have involved like a trebling of America's military budget. Now, what happened, of course, was that NSC 68 was kind of overtaken in a way by the outbreak of the Korean War. Much of what NSC 68 envisaged did come to pass, but it didn't come to pass in quite the way Acheson intended. What Acheson wanted to do was to have a kind of carefully planned diplomatic strategy to arouse and rally the support of all the Western allies towards the United States in this expansion of its military power. Didn't happen in quite that way. Instead, it all happened in a rush. It all happened kind of a headlong and kind of disorganized way during the Korean War. But nevertheless, NSC 68 is kind of a very important document because it marked the beginning of, if you like, the major phase of the Cold War.
What mark would you give Harry Truman on his handling of the Korean War?
Well, I'm afraid to say, I think there are a number of issues there. There was a failure of deterrence. The United States did give some signals to the Soviet Union and to North Korea, which were unfortunate. The signals they gave in the first half of 1950 suggested that they might not go to war on behalf of South Korea. So there was a failure of deterrence. There was also a failure of readiness. The American military in June 1950 had been depleted to some degree. The military budget had been kept down to an unrealistic level of about $13 billion a year. So the army in particular didn't have the resources it should have had. So there was a failure of readiness. There were also failures of intelligence in the lead up to the Korean War, because signs that should have been detected of the activities of Kim Il-sung in North Korea were not picked up as they should have been. So there were a series of problems before the war began. And then during the war, I think, the war was well handled for the first year or so, when you saw this remarkable recovery by the United States, by the U.S. Army and by the Marine Corps and so on, from the initial period of defeat. But then it settled down into a long period of attrition, and that long period of attrition, I think you can argue, was something that could have been avoided. The kind of approach that President Eisenhower took, which I think was more decisive and more definite, which came about after he became president, was something that really should have been tried earlier on. It'll always be controversial. It should always be very controversial. The terrible thing about the Korean War, of course, is the appalling cost of it in terms of casualties on the Korean Peninsula. And we're talking about millions and millions dead in Korea. No one really knows the exact figure. Of course, you can also add the huge losses that China suffered from its intervention. We're talking about a war that maybe cost 3 or 4 million lives. And that really is a staggering death toll, something which I think is often forgotten and really needs to be sort of much more front and center in people's consciousness of that period. The sheer cost of this appalling incident, which, as I say, was Stalin's war. Right? It was the war that Stalin wanted to fight by way of proxies, both Kim Il-sung and Mao Zedong. But it was also a war that could have been avoided if the United States had been more ready and if it had been, if it had given signals of its determination instead of that kind of failure of deterrence and readiness, which we actually saw.
36,000 Americans lost their lives in the Korean War. Mao, 1949, communism, Taiwan, it's all in the book. We're still talking about it all these years later. How did Mao become the head of China?
Well, Mao became the head of China because, of course, he won the Chinese Civil War between 1945 and 1949. And he won a series of sweeping victories in 1949 as his opponents, Chiang Kai-shek and the Nationalists, the Kuomintang, simply fell apart during that year. Now, of course, he'd had a long period of preparation. I mean, Mao's period of preparation as leader of the Chinese Communist Party went back really to the early 1930s. October 1949, he proclaims the People's Republic of China, and by that time he is the undisputed leader of China, although there was still a great deal of work to do before the Communist Party could fully consolidate its authority over the whole of the country. And then the key moment, of course, is later in that year when Mao went for the first time to Moscow to meet Joseph Stalin, a meeting which he had been wanting to achieve for several years. It had taken a long time for Stalin actually to agree that it should occur. And this produced the very important moment in February 1950 when the two men signed their Treaty of Alliance between China and the Soviet Union. Another great and very important moment, because, of course, that was another one of these moments, like NSC 68, like the Soviet detonation of the atomic bomb, which really marked the kind of maturation of the Cold War. This began the really dangerous phase of the Cold War, when the two sides became kind of locked in confrontation.
So what part of doing this book did you personally learn the most? Because you've been doing this stuff for the last several years, I mean, writing these books and everything. Where did you learn something?
I think what I found most fascinating was the interplay between the kind of domestic politics in the United States and the foreign policy. I mean, I think you have to see the two things as being continuous with each other. The foreign policy and the domestic politics kind of interact with each other all the time. And the conclusion I came up with, which is in a sense kind of common sense, is that you can't really have effective foreign policy unless you've got unity on the domestic front as well. You've got to have a degree of consensus about both, or else you're not really going to be able to function. And that was the lesson that came for me out of the book. It was something that I already took that view beforehand, but my conviction of that became stronger as the book went on. And I think also what's important is to recognize that in the United States, there are various kind of economic issues that are kind of always have to be looked at. In this particular period, the United States had a problem, which was that they were not yet confident about their economic future. Now, we think of the period after World War II, the period from the 1950s through to the 1970s, as being a great period of economic prosperity, a kind of long boom, a long economic expansion, which didn't really reach its end until we get to the presidency of Richard Nixon, reached its end about 1972, 1973. Now, at that time, people weren't confident about that. In 1949, 1950, people really weren't confident about their economic future. They were worried. They were always worried that they might lapse back into the kind of problems you'd had in the 1930s during the Great Depression. That issue of confidence, I think, is really central. It was only really in the mid-50s, when Eisenhower was the president, that confidence really sort of built up and returned in the United States in a kind of sustainable way. Prior to that, confidence was always a little bit on the fragile side. I think that's an important thing, too, that America is a country where economic issues of economic confidence is really tremendously important. At the moment, we have a situation, I think, in 2023, where we're actually, the economy is doing pretty well, not doing badly at all, unemployment very low, but people don't necessarily feel confident about the future. And you've got to address that issue of confidence. If people don't feel confident about the future, they're not going to be able to come together in any kind of political consensus on the home front, and they're not necessarily going to have a clear, decisive, and coherent strategy abroad as well. And I think so that issue of confidence is something that's absolutely central here. A lot of the problems that I'm talking about here in this book, the kind of polarization and the discord that existed, and which is symbolized by Joseph McCarthy, a lot of that arose from the fact that people really weren't confident about the future. If they had been confident about the future, I don't think they would have succumbed to that kind of bitterness and strife and polarization. I think that's still an issue now in 2023 for us now. Until people recover that kind of sense of confidence, then you're not going to see the country recover its unity either.
What 70 years later, after Great Britain and the United States won the, and Stalin, for that matter, won the World War II. Here we are. We have 800 bases around the world. We have a couple million people under arms. We're involved all over the place. Did we win or lose World War II?
Oh, I think we definitely won World War II. Definitely. I have no question about that. I think we're actually in a different world now. I think that's one of the things we have to come to terms with, is that the victories of World War II and the world that was created after World War II a world which was divided ideologically, but nevertheless had a kind of coherence to it, that really doesn't exist anymore. I think we've got to recognize that, that things have moved on, things have changed. The current world is one which feels much more disordered. I think that's because it is much more disordered. It's a much more difficult to understand, but that's kind of inevitable. Given the way that you've seen the rise, economic rise of countries that in those days were poor and agrarian, I'm talking about China and India, not just China and India, but other countries too, countries like Indonesia, countries like Bangladesh, countries with very large populations which have grown economically and which are asserting themselves on the world stage. We've got to face the fact that the world is more complicated than it was. So yes, I think definitely Britain, the United States and Soviet Union did win World War II, but I think we've got to recognize that we're now in a different situation. We're in a different kind of world with different kinds of stresses, different kinds of strains, different kinds of contradictions. There's a limited value in looking back always to World War II. Now, in this book, in my book, In the Shadow of Fear, I do look back to that period. But one of the things I'm looking back to is a period when things were changing in a big way. Suddenly, for the first time, the United States had to think about the fact that there were two big countries, Russia and China, in 1949 and 1950, who were potentially hostile, who were allied with each other. That had never existed before. Today, we have other great big challenges that have not necessarily existed before. So we've actually got to sort of move with the times. And there's always this problem, I think, in writing history and trying to look back, was you've obviously got to look for parallels. You've got to try and understand the present in terms of the past. But you've also got to be prepared to accept the fact there are times when things suddenly change in a new way. And when the past, although it's interesting and important and relevant, isn't necessarily as central as we might think it is.
So because you wrote a book on Benjamin Franklin, I have to ask you, if he came back today, of course he's not coming back today, but if he came back today, what do you think he would think of what's happened since the revolution?
Well, I think there are certain things he'd be very pleased about. I think it's very important to recognize this is kind of an optimistic conclusion, which is that he would be delighted by the America's scientific infrastructure. Now, this is the thing I think which gets neglected about Franklin. We like to think about Franklin as the author of Poor Richard's Almanac, as a witty man, a man of letters. We like to think of him as one of the authors of the Constitution of 1787. We like to think of his role in the Revolutionary War and as a diplomat in Paris. But remember, Franklin was also a scientist. And one of his great achievements in the early part of his life was his work with electricity and his work to begin creating institutions like the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia and so on. And I think what Franklin would be absolutely delighted about America is the depth and the strength of America's scientific infrastructure. He would be fascinated by that kind of thing. He'd be fascinated by Tesla, for example. He'd be fascinated by AI. He'd be fascinated also by advances in genetics. He'd be fascinated by the discoveries of pharmaceutical companies and so all those kinds. He'd be fascinated by. He'd be fascinated, and he'd be very pleased indeed to see all your great universities all across the country and all the tremendous amount of scientific research that goes on. So that's the thing I think he would be delighted by, and I think he would probably see that as being, if you like, what he thinks America actually does best. And I think he would find that a great cause of optimism for the future. So I don't think he would come back and he would say, well, isn't it terrible that, you know, our constitution is dysfunctional? Isn't it terrible that we've got these parties fighting each other? He'd say, yeah, those things are terrible. But on the other hand, you've got this enormous strength, which is the thing he tried to create in the 1740s, which is a huge amount of scientific talent, a huge amount of scientific infrastructure, not only the talent and the ingenuity and the intellectual enterprise, but also the institutions to keep it going, whether they are universities or research laboratories or whatever they might be. So I think, you know, he would actually be optimistic about the future.
Through your book, you talked about other books. Back in that time period, what other books had a major impact on the dialogue in the United States?
Well, there are a number of very interesting books published at that period. There were a whole series of interesting books that appeared in the end of 1949 and early in 1950 dealing with the circumstances of the Cold War. Now, of course, the most famous book that appeared at that period was George Orwell's novel 1984, which appeared in the summer of 1949. It was an instant bestseller in America. It was an instant bestseller in the UK. It made a great big impact, and it kind of influenced people's thinking about the future because, of course, it portrayed a world that had been shaped by nuclear conflict. So that was a hugely influential book. There was another one that appeared called The God That Failed, which was a book which actually was published in the United Kingdom, but which was very popular in the United States. That was a book about former communists who had ceased to be communists, people in the 1930s who've been communists and then ceased to be communists after that period. That was a very influential book because it became the basis for a kind of a new form of intellectual anti-communism at the time. And there was also another very interesting book, which came out actually a little bit later, in 1951, which was by William F. Buckley Jr., God and Man at Yale, which I deal with in the book. I deal with the circumstances in which God and Man at Yale came to be written. And that's very important because, of course, that was really the beginning of a kind of new form of cultural neoconservatism, which came to be very influential later. Really didn't have its full effect until the 1960s and 70s. But again, that book appeared at this period. It was published in 1951, but it was actually based upon a speech which Buckley was wanting to give at the Yale Alumni Day in February 1950, but he wasn't allowed to make. So that's another book that's very important. There are a whole series. It was a period, actually, we sort of forget this, it was actually a period of great intellectual excitement. There were a lot of very interesting writers around. There are a lot of very interesting intellectuals around. There were some very fine novels being written. There were some excellent films, too. Culturally, it was a fascinating period. And one of the great things about writing the book, one of the things I really enjoyed, was the fact there was so much material of that kind to draw upon, not only from writing, but also from the cinema and really excellent journalism, too, all of which I could draw upon to, you know, paint my picture of the period.
Why did you open one of your chapters with Ernest Hemingway?
Well, Ernest Hemingway, of course, was one of the writers who was active at the time. And he wrote a novel which was published in 1950 called Across the River and Into the Trees. And it was his first novel for 10 years. His previous novel, For Whom the Bell Tolls, had come out in 1940. Hugely successful, of course, subject to the great film with Ingrid Bergman and Gary Cooper. But he'd been kind of silent from a fictional point of view. And he brought out Across the River and Into the Trees in 1950, and it was hated by the critics. Personally, I think it's a rather better book than people give it credit for. Some of the writing is really excellent. But it was hated by the critics. And one reason why it was hated by the critics was because it's kind of such an embittered book. It's full of embittered reflections upon the kind of disillusionment that he felt after World War II. He felt that somehow or other the idealism of World War II had kind of been lost. And it also contains some extremely rude comments about Harry Truman.
Let me read.
And some rude comments.
Read a paragraph here. We'll wrap this up soon. This is quoting from the book, from Hemingway. "I'm not, nor have ever been, an unsuccessful haberdasher," said Hemingway's central character in the novel, an aging army colonel. "I have none of the qualifications for the presidency. Now we are governed in some way by the dregs. We are governed by what you find in the bottom of dead beer glasses that whores have dunked their cigarettes in." Pretty strong stuff.
Yeah, I think you can see why some people felt rather upset by that book. That was Ernest Hemingway's view of Harry Truman. He puts it, as you say, into the mouth of his central character in the novel, is this army colonel. But nevertheless, it's a very vicious thing to say about Harry Truman. It's probably the single most vicious comment anybody ever made about Harry Truman. And I think, but it's important really for two reasons. One is that it shows that at this particular point in his life, Hemingway's talent maybe was a little bit in decline. But I think what's also important about it is it just shows just how embittered and angry many people felt. I mean, Hemingway clearly felt very embittered and very angry, you know, quite extraordinarily angry and embittered. And I think that was kind of symptomatic. There were many other people who felt similarly angry and embittered by what they saw around them in 1950. And obviously from a different point of view sometimes, their politics may not have been the same as Hemingway, but I use that quotation because I thought it emblematized the atmosphere of America on the eve of the Korean War.
Where'd you get the title, In the Shadow of Fear?
That's a quotation from the British philosopher Bertrand Russell. Now, this was a time when Bertrand Russell was really in his heyday. I mean, he was immensely famous in the UK. He was famous in the United States as well, quite a controversial figure. And he wrote a book in 1949 called Values in the Atomic Age. And the epigraph of the book, I think the passage actually is, speaking from memory, we must all accept the fact that we're living in the shadow of fear. And what he was talking about was the atomic bomb. He wanted to, his book was an attempt at kind of a philosophical reflection on the implications of the existence of these new weapons of mass destruction. And so that's where the title came from. Now, later, a few years later, Bertrand Russell became one of the leaders of the International Movement for Nuclear Disarmament. That was after the hydrogen bomb test in 1954. At this particular point, he was less convinced about the dangers of atomic warfare, but nevertheless, he still felt that it was kind of a decisive moment in the history of civilization. He felt it was a dangerous moment, and he felt that it was a fearful and anxious moment. And again, that's something that I wanted to use his quote, that quotation from him, kind of express that kind of mood of anxiety, which was kind of, to some extent, pervasive in 1949 and 1950.
Have you started your next book?
Well, I'm considering another book. I've started work on it. Yeah, I tend to be quite superstitious about these things. I don't like talking about products until I actually know they're going to happen. But I mean, I'm considering another book, which would be a book about a period of about 4 or 5 years later. I'd be dealing, instead of dealing with 1949-1950, I'd be dealing with the year 1954 and 1955. That's another very interesting period, because that's the period when the French lost the war in Vietnam, the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, where they were defeated. It's the point at which the hydrogen bombs were actually being tested. They weren't simply being dreamt up in a laboratory, they're actually being tested. And it's also the point at which Eisenhower was really emerging as the great leader that he would become. He was elected November 1952, came into office January 1953, but it's really in the middle of 1954 and then 1955 that Eisenhower really stamped his authority on the United States. And I'd be exploring some of the same issues as I did in The Shadow of Fear, but I'd be sort of moving them 4 or 5 years forward into a new period. And that was also a fascinating period because it was the period of something called the Bandung Conference. The Bandung Conference was a great conference held in 1955 in Indonesia. It was a conference attended by what we would now call the countries of the Global South, Indonesia, India, China, and so on. It was a great moment because it was a moment at which you would start to see the emergence of the Global South as a political force on the world scene. And that occurred, as I say, in 1955, just 5 years after the events I was dealing with this book. So that's what my next book, I hope, will be about. But as I say, I tend to be rather wary about talking about new projects just in case they don't come to pass.
Well, this is about the 1950s area, early 50s, In the Shadow of Fear, America and the World in that year. And we thank you, Nick Bunker, for joining us.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Thanks for listening to the Book Notes Plus podcast. Please rate and review Book Notes Plus, and don't forget to follow so you never miss an episode. Questions or comments, we would love to hear from you. You can email us at podcasts@c-span.org.